So today's class is a little bit of an introduction. It's actually a good thing you came today, because we're now starting a new story arc in Sefer Shmuel, in the book of Samuel. Up until now, chapters 1 through 7 have been about the Philistines and about Samuel himself. But it's kind of funny. It's called the book of Samuel, but Samuel is really not the main character of the book. The main person in the book is going to be King Saul and then King David. These are going to be the main characters in the book. And what happens in chapter 8, which is the chapter that we're up to, is the people of Israel beg Samuel to let them have a king. We're going to read it next week. Next week there's no class. In 2 weeks, we're going to read chapter 8, in which Bnei Israel beg of Samuel to give them a king. Find us a king. And Samuel originally doesn't like the idea. Why don't you think he likes the idea of having a king?
It's like a form of worship. People tend to put the king on a pedestal and forget about God. Then they focus on the king and what the king wants.
So maybe the king could be a form of idolatry. Okay, anybody else?
Well, he could have wanted to be the top person.
So maybe Samuel believes there should be no division between the political leadership and the religious leadership, and that he as the prophet should remain the king. That's another possibility, right? So now there's two possibilities on the table as to why Samuel didn't think they should have a king. One, because monarchy might lead to idolatry. And two, because maybe there should not be a division between the religious leadership and the political leadership. But rather, whoever is the prophet should also be the political leader.
Well, the basic thing is, I mean, it's related to the first one, but we have a king. And
who does?
The Jewish people. They always have a king, that could get confusing.
Okay. So, before we read that chapter in Samuel and see Samuel's reaction and what they end up doing, I mean, obviously we know that in the end they're going to have a king, because Saul, we know that there's King Saul and King David and King Solomon, so we know what the answer is going to be. But before we read that whole process, today's class is going to be a little bit of an introduction to the idea of monarchy in the Torah. Because the truth is that the Torah, in Sefer Dvarim, in the book of Deuteronomy, regards the idea, the possibility of having a king. Take a look at source number 1 on the page. This is from Parashat Shoftim. Ki tavo el haaretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach virishta v'yashavta ba. If when you enter the land that God has given you and you inherit it and you settle in it, Ve'amarta asima alai melech kechol agoyim asher svivotai. And you say, please, let's put a king over us, like all the other nations have around us. So tasima lecha melech. Then you shall be free to set a king over yourself. Asher yifchar Hashem Elokecha bo, that God shall choose. Mikerav achecha tasim alecha melech, lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri asher lo achichahu. From one of your own people, you should pick a king. The king should not be a non-Jew, should not be a foreigner. So, what do you make of these psukim? Read the English again to yourselves, or the Hebrew if you prefer.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Take
a minute again to reread it.
I like what it says, mitzvah of monarchy.
That's my title. That's not in the Torah,
though. That is a mitzvah. You look at it, it's such a nice...
because it says, you can feel free to set a king over yourself, one chosen by the Lord your God.
And so what?
I said he's going to be Jewish.
Okay.
And that's consistent with our God.
Okay.
Yes.
The big question is it a Mitzvah. Mitzvah doesn't mean good deed. It means commandment. Okay? Mitzvah means commandment. Is it a commandment to establish a king? Or is it not a commandment to have a king? What do you think based on these verses? Is it a commandment to have a king? No. Or is it not a commandment?
Not, because it's if you decide. You decide.
If you're stupid enough to want a king.
And first you decide, and also you shall be free to set a king.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the spies. Hashem said it's all right to send spies, but he didn't really like it.
Okay. Right, he agreed. He acceded to the request.
And also with Bilam. All right, you can go with them, but you can only say what I tell you to say.
Okay. Now, the reason why you might think it is a mitzvah is that verse 15, even though it's translated here by JPS as "you shall be free to set a king," the actual Hebrew, "Som tasim alecha melech," the simple translation is "you shall surely put a king upon yourself." That's the language used often for mitzvot. That's why you might think it is a mitzvah, right? Som tasim alecha melech. You shall surely establish a king for yourself. Pick a king. Find a king.
And that'll free himself. Be sure to set a king. Okay.
You why would they even consider a foreigner? That doesn't make sense.
That's a good question. Why does God have to tell them not to put a foreigner as the king? Well, because the reason why they want a king, according to the previous verse, is because they want to be like all the other nations. So perhaps what God is saying here is when you do pick a king, you got to pick your own king. You can't just become part of the other nations and use their king. Meaning they might have thought, oh well, we live near the Canaanites. Let's just join the Canaanites and use their king. No. So they said, no, you have to have your own king.
Your own territory.
But here also the what you were just asking about, it's emphatic, like you know that expression. If you do decide you want a king, then you shall surely choose one that God wants.
So it almost sounds like it might be a mitzvah, but maybe it's an optional mitzvah. If you want a king, then it's a mitzvah to have one, right? If it's a situational mitzvah, right? Situational mitzvah. Should this just, you know, it's there are many situational mitzvahs. If you have a doorway, you have to put up a mezuzah. You don't have a doorway, you have to put up a mezuzah. So if you want a king, then it's a mitzvah to have a king. If you don't want a king, you don't have to, you know, then it's not a mitzvah anymore. But the minute there's a desire, the minute people want a king, it becomes a mitzvah to have one. What do you think?
So, well, it says here, chosen by the Lord your God. And then, you know, that seems like a very specific thing. But then it says, well, you have the choice. You put a foreigner or not put a foreigner or a foreigner. You know what I mean? There seems to be a little bit of a paradox there.
Yeah, it's a little bit strange.
You've got your choice, but it has to be chosen by God.
Right.
It says, be sure to set a king over yourself, one of your own people.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
So when you say it's a mitzvah, it has to be done in a certain way.
And therefore what?
And therefore, you have to follow the rules of choosing the king.
That's right. So that's the benefit of having it as a... So let's say... So now what we have is maybe it's an optional mitzvah. Not an option... I mean, that's an oxymoron also. Not an optional mitzvah. Maybe if the majority of Jews want a king, then it becomes a mitzvah to have a king. Why should it be? Why should there be such a mitzvah? Because the minute God makes a mitzvah, then God and then later on the rabbis can set the paradigms and the rules surrounding it. Were there no such mitzvah, there'd be no rules, right? If there was no, let's say, if people want a king, and there was no mitzvah to have a king, and there were no rules about it, then everybody wants a king. Okay, we'll make a king, and then there are no. But then there's no. Framework in which to limit and in which to create the possibility of a king, right? It's just up to the people to decide how they want to do it. By making it into a situational commandment, a situational mitzvah, God allows the rabbis, not us rabbis, but you know the Talmud, the rabbis who sat on the Sanhedrin and so on, to to create rules for the king. What do you think about that?
Could I go back to the first sentence?
Sure.
Where it says, if you want to be like the others around you, like, that's nothing to them. Why would they want to be like the others around them anyway? That doesn't seem like a positive point.
That's right.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Okay.
But I think he's saying that it's only natural for people to want to be like the others around them. And also maybe they'll see value in having a king. You know, when you have a king, you have somebody who leads the wars and, you know, takes care of the needs of everybody because he's the government. Maybe they'll see a value in having government. Maybe while the Jews are a very small people, they don't really need a big government. But once they grow, they need some kind of government. Now, maybe that government doesn't need to be a monarchy. Maybe it doesn't need to be a king. Maybe it could be something else.
Somebody you can see. And people need something they can see. Hashem is really the king, but we can't see him. So I think maybe Hashem realizes that we need something more concrete.
Right. So why can't it just be the prophet? Let's go back. Why shouldn't the religious leader also be the political leader?
Prophets aren't personally, the personalities aren't suited to that type of leaders.
So what are they if not leaders?
They point the way, let's say.
Okay.
Teachers.
The king also is the lightning rod for all the criticisms. Yeah. It's somebody you can complain about.
That's right.
And there's also pageantry.
Pageantry. Maybe it's because the political, you know, like any politics, you know, everybody always hates the politicians because politicians have to make, in order to get things accomplished, politicians have to make compromises. Because otherwise nothing will get done, right, in politics. So in order to make things happen, the politicians have to make compromises and sort of act politically. And maybe that's not befitting of a prophet. And maybe a prophet can't make compromises. A prophet is directed by God. So a prophet is not in a position to lead in a political manner in that way. Could be.
A prophet can't be a leader of compromises. That's the way I feel.
Right.
A prophet cannot be
well,
a
what did they
leader
do before? They looked for a leader.
Before there was a king, there were judges who just, you know, there were multiple different judges and they were more localized. There was no one central leader of all the Jews. The only leader was the prophet, but there was no political leader of all the Jews.
Now, where was this happening? Were they in Jerusalem at this time?
They were all over Israel.
All over.
Yeah. All over Israel.
I didn't know mitzvah was a commandment.
Yeah,
so
mitzvah.
In other words, if you have a desire, and that's considered mitzvah. Okay.
What do you mean?
Well, if you have a desire to have a king or to have a leader, then that's considered a commandment, isn't it?
Well, if you have a desire to have a king, what this verse says is that if there is a desire among the people to have a king, then it becomes a commandment to have a king. That's not always true. If there's a desire to eat pork, it doesn't become a mitzvah to eat pork. So, meaning it's not that mitzvah doesn't always follow desire.
There's limitations, I understand.
Mitzvah in general just means commandment. Things that you have to do if you're Jewish. Or, as the case may be, not Jewish also. So it's a mitzvah to put a mezuzah on a doorpost. It's a mitzvah to, you know, build a balcony, build a banister on the roof, on a flat roof of a home. That's a mitzvah. They're mitzvot. They're delineated in the Torah. Yeah.
That's not a
mitzvah. No, right. But what I was just giving an extreme example.
Yeah.
Okay. The rabbis of the Talmud were not so clear as to how to read this verse. Let's read this. We'll just read in English. Source 2 from the Talmud and Tractate Sanhedrin. We're going to read three opinions. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nehorai, and Rabbi Yossi. And thus Rabbi Yehuda said, three commandments were given to Israel when they entered the land. 1, to appoint a king. 2, to cut off the seed of Amalek. And three, to build themselves the chosen house. To build themselves the temple. Mm-hmm. So, according to Rabbi Yehuda, there's a mitzvah to appoint a king. Regardless of, meaning it's, once you enter the land, there's a mitzvah to appoint a king. It's not an optional thing. While Rabbi Nehorai said, this section was spoken only in anticipation of their future murmurings. Meaning that whole verse 15, where it says you have to put a king, pick a king, that was only said in response and in anticipation of the fact that Bnei Yisrael, the Jews, are really going to want a king and they're going to murmur about it. As it is written, and they shall say, I will set a king over me. It has been taught, Rabbi Eliezer said, the elders of the generation made a fit request. As it is written, give us a king to judge us. But the Am Haaretz acted unworthily, as it is written, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go before us. So, according to Rabbi Eliezer, there were two different groups of people in the days of Samuel that wanted a king. The elders who acted properly, and the hoi polloi, Am Haaretz means the hoi polloi. The hoi polloi who did not act properly.
Oh, and the hoi polloi is the one who says because they want to be like everybody else.
That's right. The hoi polloi want to be like everybody else. I mean, that's almost in the definition of being the hoi polloi.
What language is that?
Hoi polloi is English. I mean, it's English. Maybe it's from Latin. I don't know. But it's an English word. No. Yeah, Greek, Latin. It's not, it doesn't sound like it. Maybe Latin. I would guess Latin. It almost sounds Yiddish. There's certain, you know, there's a bunch of words in English that sound Yiddish. Hoi polloi. There are, you know,
not Yiddish.
What? No, there are other words that sound Yiddish, like
Google it.
Or Google it. That's right. Bagel. Bagel sounds like it's in Yiddish, you know.
Well, it is.
Even Google sounds like it's Yiddish.
Yeah.
Google.
Yeah, Google.
Google.
That's right. Okay. Are you Googling it, Chaim?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's H-O-I.
Ancient Greek.
Oh, it's ancient. Oh, good job, Faye.
Right.
Ooh.
Right.
Who said that?
Sharkochach, Faye said it.
It means the many, or in the strictest sense, the majority. In English, it has been corrupted by giving it a negative connotation to signify deprecation of the working class commoners, the masses, or common people, in a derogatory or ironic.
So I took 4 years of Latin, so I knew it wasn't Latin.
There you go.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's either Greek or Latin.
Okay. Then it has also been taught, Rabbi Yossi said, three commandments were given to Israel when they entered the land, to appoint a king, to cut off the seed of Amalek, to build themselves a chosen house. So Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda held that it was a commandment, whereas Rabbi Nehorai held that it was not a mitzvah. It was only in response to a desire to have a king. And there were many interpretations of how we actually rule. The majority opinion among the commentaries is that it is a mitzvah to have a king. Maimonides held that it was a mitzvah. And the Sefer HaChinuch, which I printed over here, I didn't have the translation accessible to me. But the Sefer HaChinuch and source number 3 says that is a mitzvah to have a king. Limanot melech mi Yisrael. Mitzvah number 497. Right, the Sefer HaChinuch is an anonymous book. We don't know who wrote it. But it's somebody in the medieval period in Spain who went through all of the... You know, the Talmud says there are 613 commandments. But it doesn't say what those 613 commandments are. So, you know, the rabbi said, challenge accepted. And they went through the Torah trying to find what are the commandments? What's a commandment? Because if you list everything, it could be a commandment. You'll get a lot more than 613. So they have to figure out what's a commandment, what's not a commandment. So Maimonides has his book. It's called Sefer HaMitzvot. The Ramban commented on that book and he disagreed with certain things. I think the Ramban disagrees with roughly 10 or so mitzvot that the Rambam had. He disagrees with some of the details, but there are certain things the Rambam said was a mitzvah, and the Ramban says it's not a mitzvah, and vice versa. Things the Rambam said was not a mitzvah, or didn't list as a mitzvah, and the Ramban, one of the famous ones is settling the land of Israel, Rambam did not hold that settling the land of Israel was a mitzvah. And the Ramban says that's crazy. It is a mitzvah to settle the land of Israel. That's a big, you know, a big dispute between the Rambam. That's probably the most famous, most important debate between the Rambam and the Ramban, is the whether it's actually a mitzvah to settle the land of Israel. According to the Ramban, settling the land of Israel is such an important mitzvah that all of the other mitzvot only apply in the land of Israel. Everything else is only derabanan. Meaning, all the mitzvot that we do here, the fact that we don't eat pork in New York State is only derabanan. It's not d'oraisa, according to the Ramban. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Nothing is d'oraisa in New York, according to the Ramban. Don't get any ideas, folks.
How about Indiana?
Yeah, that's... anywhere. But the Sefer HaChinuch is the most often quoted compilation of the 613 commandments, because he goes in the order of the Torah. So he goes parsha by parsha. So in every parsha, he tells you how many commandments are in the parsha. You know, it's pretty narrow in Bereishit and Shemot. But once you get into Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Dvarim, there are a lot of commandments per parsha. And he gives a whole lot, you know, if you want to know the basics of Judaism, Sefer HaChinuch is the best book to read. It's in simple Hebrew. There are translations available. But it's a fairly simple book, and he goes through each commandment, the reasons for the commandment, the basic rules of the commandment. You know, it's not a lot of detail. It's the whole book is, you know, this thick. It's not Bible paper, very, you know, regular paper. It's not, you know, it's a good project to follow along Sefer HaChinuch with the Parsha. It would be a commendable project to do so. And it's available with vowels and everything. He explains all the mitzvah. So he says it is a mitzvah to appoint a king. So when he says that something's a mitzvah, that's significant. That means he holds it's a mitzvah. We were commanded to appoint a king. In order that he should congregate all of us together and that he should lead us as he desires. That's what the king is for, to bring everybody together. We read that verse. That's why it says, you shall surely appoint for yourselves a king. And then he explains the roots of the commandment. I already have explained in a previous mitzvah the benefit in having one person be a leader and a captain for everybody. Because people cannot live peacefully together without a leader, without government. And Sefer Shoftim. And see what happened in the book of Judges, when there were many different local leaders, but not one leader. There was chaos. It didn't work very well. So it's a very practical mitzvah. It's a mitzvah according to the Sefer HaChinuch, from a practical
government.
Right? The most famous Rishon medieval commentary who disagrees with that is the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel lived in Renaissance Italy. And he did not agree with the idea that there should be one king. He doesn't think it's a mitzvah to have a king. I have a translation here on the next page. Behold, it is fitting that we know if a king is a necessary and intrinsically obligatory thing for a nation, or whether it is possible without him. And the philosophers already thought that it was necessary, and that the dominion of a king to a politically organized nation is like the relationship of the heart to the body of a living being that has a heart. Meaning, all the philosophers, they believed the king was necessary for a nation. And even though these analysts reason that monarchy ensures three things: unity, the absence of division, the second being continuity and the lack of instability, and the third being absolute power, in fact, their thinking about the obligation and necessity of a king is false. This is since it is not to be denied that there can be many leaders of the people that gather and unite and agree upon one policy, and that the leadership and law can be according to them. Meaning what? He's talking about a Republican form of government. Many different leaders gather together, sort of not something so different from what we have here. Representatives of different people that get together and make the rules together. And this goes against the first claim. And why should their leadership not be for 1 year or 3 years like the years of an employee or less? I mean, there should be term limits. It shouldn't be a king that, you know, rules forever. It should be term limits. And when the turn of other judges and officers arrives, they will rise instead of them and faithfully investigate the sins of the first ones. That's what happens too. Yeah. And that which they condemn must pay all that they have done badly. And this goes against the second claim. Why should their power also not be limited? That is with most religions and mores. And logic dictates that when an individual disagrees with the group, the law follows the group. Majority rule. And it is more likely that the lapse be with one man, as it is stated, the king's wrath is a messenger of death, than the many would trespass when they take counsel together. Meaning it's more likely that one leader will make a mistake than many leaders make a mistake. I don't know if that's really true either. As if one strays from the path, the others will protest against him. And since their leadership is temporary and they will have to be accountable after a few days, that fear of flesh and blood is upon them. Why do we need to bring theoretical claims for this? As behold...
Somebody's phone. Yeah, it's just CVS telling me I'm going to get my medicine.
Experience trumps modeling. Look and see the lands of the leadership, of which is the king's. Okay, we don't have to read the whole thing. The upshot is that the Abarbanel holds that it's not a mitzvah at all to appoint a king, but rather that a king might not even be the best form of government. It could be that they need a king or that they want a king like everybody else, because everybody else at that point in the ancient Near East had a king. They didn't have democracies in the ancient Near East. They had kings. And so, according to the Abarbanel, the whole idea of having a king is only as a concession to the will of the people, but it's not really a mitzvah, and it's not God's ideal situation. It's not God's ideal plan. What do you think?
I think he's right.
But that seems to be the simple reading, right? If you read 14 and 15, the two verses together, it reads like it's a response to a desire. It doesn't read like it's an a priori commandment, like, oh, you got to have a king. That's a necessary thing to have a king. That doesn't sound like that.
It's sort of like human nature to want a king.
Right, maybe that's what it is, the concession to human nature. We know that Maimonides has already written, and we discussed this in a previous class, that many of the commandments are concessions to human nature. So it's actually not contradictory, right? It could be that it is a commandment, but notwithstanding that, it's a concession to human nature. According to Maimonides, sacrifices were a concession to human nature. I'll let you in on a secret. According to some readers of Maimonides, they read Maimonides as saying that prayer is also a concession to human nature. Isn't that wild? Yeah. That if you read according to Maimonides, the ideal relationship with God is completely contemplative and intellectual. And that prayer is just something modern day religious people need in order to relate to God. But really, the ideal would not be prayer. The ideal would just be contemplation.
Even a minion, same thing.
The whole thing. The whole enterprise of prayer is a concession to human nature.
It's true. It's needed, though.
Yeah, people need prayer. I can't tell you when somebody is in, you know, God forbid, in the hospital or something, people want to pray on their behalf. When somebody's close friend, they say, Rabbi, can I give you their Hebrew name? Rabbi, what is this person's Hebrew name so I can daven on their behalf? Or, you know, what is the proper prayer? Which tehillim should I say to pray for this person's well-being? People, you know, people find that very powerful.
You know, there's a very well-known doctor, Michael Dassey. Have you ever heard of him?
I've not.
Anybody? He's written a bunch of very interesting books about the power of prayer. And he claims that there were experiments that were done where people prayed for, this is not Jewish, but they prayed for individuals like really like 10,000 miles away. The people didn't even know they were being prayed for, but they got better. So this is just like a really interesting study. And when they know they're being prayed for, they get even better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So interesting psychological.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a lot to be said for the psychological aspects of our medical well-being.
There was a book written about the power of prayer on plants also.
Yeah.
Same idea. Prayer on plants.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What do you mean, the plant growing?
Yeah, that a plant will flourish if you give it that attention.
It's like a little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah. Before that.
Please grow for me. Yeah. It grows. You have to be careful what you pray for.
That's true.
We always have to
be careful
what you pray for.
That's right. And so, is it good to tell somebody you're praying for them? Or not?
Definitely. Look, it works. Well, it depends for whom. Some people don't. You know, some people don't like it. I'll tell you. You know, some people are more introverted and don't want people to know about their illness and don't want to know. That's how I am personally. I mean, when I first when I became a rabbi, okay. Now we can turn the recording back on. So Maimonides in chapter 27 of the third volume of the Guide to the Perplexed. Really sets out an amazing view of the law. This is just in general about halacha. And it relates to the mitzvah of monarchy as well. The law as a whole, I mean, Maimonides has a unique perspective on this. Not everybody agrees with Maimonides. But Maimonides believed that all mitzvot basically serve the purpose. This is very different from the Hasidic view of mitzvot, right? And the way I like to describe it is that, you know, Lubavitch stands out in the streets and has people put on tefillin. And there's something to be said for that. But they really believe that just the fact that one Jew put on tefillin once, that that's a very meaningful thing, and that, you know, it's an important thing that has taken place. But Maimonides would say, unless that one act of putting on tefillin really brought this person to being a better person and to doing something, you know, to really becoming an integral part of the Jewish people in some way, that is not necessarily an important act. Is that meaning the Hasidic theology is that every mitzvah that being done by any Jew puts together the world. But the Maimonidean theology is not that at all. It's that the mitzvot are all there as a whole to serve a function and to serve a purpose. And that's what he says here. The law as a whole aims at two things: the welfare of the soul and the welfare of the body. As for the welfare of the soul, it consists in the multitudes acquiring correct opinions corresponding to their respective capacity. Right. So that means that people should believe in the right things, meaning believing in God and not believing in idolatry. So there's a whole slew of commandments that their whole purpose is to take us away from idolatry. Sacrifices is one of them, because we specifically have rules about sacrificing to God as opposed to sacrificing to idols. Many of our commandments, according to Maimonides, are meant to remove us from idolatry. Therefore, some of them are set forth explicitly and some of them in parables. For it is not within the nature of the common multitude that its capacity should suffice for apprehending the subject matter as it is. As for the welfare of the body, it comes about by the improvement of their ways of living one with another. This is achieved through two things. One of them is the abolition of their wrongdoing each other. This is why Lashon Hara, for example, is a mitzvah. This is, you know, all these things. This is welfare of the body. This is tantamount to every individual among the people not being permitted to act according to his own will and up to the limits of his power, but being forced to do that which is useful to the whole. Right, this is opposed to Nietzsche's philosophy. Nietzsche thought that everybody should, you know, act according to the maximum amount of their power, and that was really the natural. I mean, Nietzsche's not telling you that's what you should do. Nietzsche was saying that's what people do. He was an existential philosopher, which meant that he was describing what people do. He wasn't telling people what to do. Maimonides tells people what to do. He's not describing existential philosophy. He's explaining what you should do. You should not live that way. You should limit. You should not live according to your will and up to the limits of your own power, but being forced to do that which is useful to the whole. The second thing consists in the acquisition by every human individual of moral qualities that are useful for life and society, so that the affairs of the city may be ordered. Know that as between these two aims, one is indubitably greater in nobility, namely the welfare of the soul, I mean procuring of correct opinions, while the second aim, the welfare of the body, is prior in nature and time. So welfare of the soul is more important, but in order to have welfare of the soul, you have to have welfare of the body first. The latter aim consists in the governance of the city and the well-being of the states of all its people according to their capacity. So government is part of this welfare of the body. Right, government is there to make sure people don't kill each other and, you know, do things that are, you know, necessary for society. Okay?
Eat too much sugar.
Yeah. So, again, it could very well be that monarchy is a mitzvah, but that it is in response to a human need and to something in human nature. And those are not contradictory. Right? A mitzvah doesn't need to be something a priori. Mitzvot could be concessions to human need on the part of God. God understanding that he's creating a system for people to live in. And for that system to work, maybe we need a monarchy. Okay?
So are you saying that, like, if I do something good for somebody, that's not a mitzvah?
Sure it is.
Okay.
Sure it is. Okay, we're going to stop here for today. We will, yeah.
Use the word a priori.
A priori means that there's...
I worked as a legal...
Oh, okay.
Could you remind me, Rambam, settling in Israel and not settling in Israel, which was which?
Rambam does not hold that settling Israel is a commandment.
Okay.
Maimonides. But Nachmanides disagreed and said that it is a commandment.
Thank you.
Next week, we're going to read chapter 8 of the book of Samuel. In 2 weeks, we're going to read chapter 8 of the book of Samuel and see how the people request the king and Samuel's initial opposition. And we're going to relate it to this background information, this kind of idea about the mitzvah of having a king.